You're listening to LawPod UK from the creators of the UK Human Rights Blog. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at One Crown Office Row.
I'm Rosalind English. And in this podcast, I'll be talking over Skype to David Hart QC about the Great Repeal Bill, now called the European Withdrawal Bill, which gives this country a framework for withdrawal from the EU. He's written about it on our blog, highlighting in particular his concerns about the lack of attention given to the enforcement of environmental standards after Brexit. There are, of course, other aspects of the withdrawal bill that have attracted rather more attention, such as the failure to roll over the EU Charter of Rights into domestic law. One commentator on our blog, responding to David's post, has suggested that this may simply be a tactical move on the government's part, that reversing the charter conclusion would be an easy concession for the government to make when passing the bill. Whether or not this is the case, let's hear what David has to say about some of what he sees to be the shortcomings of this bill. What, in your words, is the main heavy lifting that this withdrawal bill is designed to do?
Well, it starts from a position of abolishing the European Communities Act. But what it then has to do is bring all of European legislation into our domestic law. And there are various different problems it faces. The first thing it has to do is to deal with things which are currently in primary or secondary legislation, but are only there because they're implementing EU law. You'll have a statutory instrument which says the Secretary of State is doing this pursuant to Section 2 of the European Communities Act. And as from exit day, there won't be a European Communities Act. But what there will be is this bill doing the same job as the European Communities Act did. So that's the first thing, first set of laws that have to be domesticated. The second set consists of directly effective EU legislation, so that's EU regulations and EU Commission decisions, and they need to be made part of domestic law again after the European Communities Act has been repealed. And then the third bit of lifting is that various bits of the EU treaty need to be lifted into domestic law, and particularly that involves directly effective rights under that treaty. And the obvious examples of those are things like citizenship rights, free movement of goods, equal pay, state aid, abuse of a dominant position in competition law. So all those things, however controversial they may be eventually, get rolled into domestic law and then get sorted out bit by bit as the process of Brexit continues.
And there are much debated controversies in this process, particularly over the EU Charter of Rights.
Yes, what this bill proposes to do to the Charter is simply not roll it over at all, so it will disappear. And it claims to do that because it says, and that's the explanatory notes of the bill, it says that everything in the Charter is already somewhere to be found in the rest of EU law that is being rolled over. Well, that's not quite accurate. It's a posture that governments have been taking for the last 15 years. And the controversy here is really about the substantive bits of the Charter which should or shouldn't be rolled over. And I can't see why the Charter should not be rolled over, and then the debates should then emerge, just as the debates about some of the substantive rights which I've been talking about earlier, as to whether they should be rolled over. Why should there be a difference?
Another main controversy that we've heard a lot about are these so-called Henry VIII clauses, and you write about them in your blog post. Can you just remind us how that's turned out in the bill?
Yes, well, the bill envisages, as I've already said, lots of sub-bills dealing with different areas. And in order to ease this passage, Clause 7 says that the minister may make regulations as he thinks appropriate to prevent, remedy or mitigate any failure of EU law to operate effectively or, and this is important, any other deficiency in retained EU law. So what this is saying is that if there's a glitch anywhere in any of this, a minister may promulgate regulations correcting it, which gives an enormous area of responsibility to the minister, subject only to some relatively basic protections afforded by putting papers before Parliament and the like. So the ordinary way in which regulations are made in all sorts of different tiny areas are now being applied to this massive, different and much more controversial area. And so the debate is how that should be done. I don't think anybody is saying that there should not be some sort of wide power, but the real question is to what extent ought it to be scrutinised by Parliament.
And yes, we've had a lot of discussion about that, but what seems to be rather undiscussed or underdiscussed is what you call the euro claims, which concern rights and liabilities that are built into the case law of the European Court. Could you tell us a little bit more about how they are dealt with in the bill and what will be their status when we come out of Europe?
Yes, I haven't seen much debate about what the government is seeking to delete from some of the principles built up by the European Court. And one principle is the idea of direct effect. And the second principle, and perhaps more importantly for present purposes, is what's called the rule in Frankovic. This is a way of keeping governments up to the mark for fear of being held liable in damages if the governments do not properly transpose or implement some European directive. So if the courts conclude that the directive in question was intended to confer rights upon individuals, and the court also concludes that the breach of EU law was sufficiently serious, the member state, the government, may be held liable in damages. And in this bill, the government has just slipped in a clause which says there is no right in domestic law after exit day to damages in accordance with the rule in Frankovic. So this is not rolling over what's going on into European law. It's simply cutting it off. So what the government has done in this bill is to abolish the rule in Frankovic as from exit day. And so it will be more difficult to sue the government for breaches of what it fails to do in respect of directives, even if the questions and the issues arise before exit day. So say the government has been in breach of a water pollution directive or an air pollution directive for years and years and years. This will abolish any claim against the government for that liability, subject only to one limitation, which is that if an action is begun before exit day, then the liability will subsist. But as I say, that doesn't deal with the long accrued claims. So it is a major exception to the general principle of this bill, which is to roll everything in European law into UK law before we decide to do what we're going to do with it.
So let me just make sure that I understand this correctly. If a claim hasn't been taken in the UK courts or indeed in the European court, it will no longer exist after exit from the EU.
It will no longer exist after exit day, except if that claim has been commenced before exit day.
And you mention air pollution and water pollution as a possible grounding for a Frankovic claim. And that brings us to your particular expertise, which of course is in environmental law. And what is not set out in the bill that we're talking about is any way in which EU environmental laws are going to be enforced, given at the moment the EU Commission is the main enforcer. Can one simply take out of the equation this system?
Yes, it has quite a complicated formal procedure, ultimately resulting in the Commission bringing a case before the Court of Justice saying that a given member state hasn't done enough in respect of some directive, and it sends formal letters to member states. It encourages them to try and resolve the position, but ultimately it can tell the member state that it is in breach of its obligations, and it can impose financial penalty when the member state doesn't do anything about those breaches. Now, that's all going because any reference to the European Court is going post-Brexit. And so the obvious question is, how is European environmental law, which is going to be rolled over into English law, going to be enforced? And enforced not simply against private polluters or the like, but against governments who are simply not doing what they should be doing in respect of individual directives. And the answer is, there are no proposals for that. So what it seems to be intended is that the current ways of seeking to hold government to account in domestic law are having to do the full duty of what the European Commission does at the moment.
What makes the environment a special case here?
It's a special case because nobody speaks for the environment in the way that the unions or the employers' federations speak for him in equal pay cases. Quite often there is no obvious economic loser in an environment case. The loser is the environment. It doesn't fit into the pattern of much of European law, which has very strong enforcers built into the system anyway. It's not like pursuing an individual polluter, where it is an agency of the state that pursues that polluter. Here we have to find some way of making sure the government do what they agreed to do.
Why isn't our well-established and sophisticated system of calling public bodies to account under judicial review, isn't that enough to ensure environmental compliance by public bodies at least?
Well, it makes a start and it's undoubtedly a good backstop, but it cannot begin to replicate what the European Commission does. The European Commission takes complaints from individuals free of charge. It asks member states what's been going on. It can commission studies into what's been going on. And then it can decide whether to enforce. It can take as long as that takes. Well, there are a whole host of reasons why judicial review is simply not enough by itself to do all that work. The first is that there is a very sharp time limit in the form of 3 months from the relevant decision until you have to begin proceedings. In those 3 months, you may have to analyse very significant amounts of complex data to decide whether there is a case. Secondly, you don't have any of the investigation tools which the European Commission would have. Thirdly, you have to have the money. And in an environmental context, that may be an NGO who has particular interest in whatever the area is. Not every area of the environment has a NGO ready and willing to hop into action in that way. So one needs to come up with a system where a rather more systematic view is being taken as to breaches and which ones are to be enforced, rather than one driven by particular interest groups.
And then, of course, there's the whole question of costs.
Absolutely. In a judicial review, the basic rule is if you lose, you have to pay the other side's costs. There are various provisions in respect of environmental cases where that is to some extent mitigated, but it's still a very considerable deterrent, the prospect that you might have pay the other side's costs, even leaving aside your own costs. And one of the thoughts that has come out of some recent work done by the UK Environmental Law Association in a recent paper just published a couple of days ago is that the court system ought to be amended or tweaked in some sort of way so that this costs rule should not apply. We do have a system of environmental appeals called the First Tier Tribunal, which at the moment deals with a motley group of various different types of appeal. And the important thing about that tribunal is that, generally speaking, it does not order costs. So if one found some amendment of those cost rules, and indeed as to jurisdiction, you might well get a form of judicial review which was more able to meet the requirements of NGOs and others. But even so, that's not enough. There needs to be some rather more systematic looking at the way in which domesticated EU law is enforced here.
We've covered many complexities in this discussion, and details are summarised in the UKLA Brexit and Environmental Law Report, and you'll find a link to this report on David's post that has just gone up on the blog. You suggest in your post that the Great Repeal Bill is obviously up for long-term debating. Is there anything wrong with this?
Well, nothing wrong apart from the current two-year period for withdrawal. The longer we spend debating this bill, the less time we have to debate all the bills that are going to follow on from it. And everything is going to get concertinaed into a short period, which is highly undesirable given the importance and complexity of what we're all trying to do here.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.